Archaeological sites help us decipher the story of a place. So how well do Pennsylvania's laws protect these sites, some nearly 1,000 years old, from oil and gas drilling?
Even if it's recorded with the state, you could bulldoze it away if you wanted to.
This week on the Allegheny Front, Native American burial sites, gas wells, and private property rights. And satellite imagery shows just how much land in Appalachia has been disturbed by mountaintop removal mining.
That's about 2.8 times the size of Great Smoky Mountains National Park. So it's a really big area.
Plus, we have a story perfect for the dog days of summer.
When I go on the river to this day, all my problems go away.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf and his administration are concerned the federal government will reduce states' abilities to enact a vehicle emission standard that's tougher than the federal one. WITF's Katie Meyer reports they're already reacting to an expected proposal from the Trump administration.
Currently, federal rules will require cars and light trucks to get 50 miles to the gallon by 2025. But the Environmental Protection Agency plans to propose freezing it at 35 miles per gallon from 2020 to 2026. The plan may also rescind California's ability to set its own emission standards, which Pennsylvania adopted in 2006. State Department of Environmental Protection Secretary Patrick McDonnell says some states don't intend to give it up.
This would be the first time where the federal government has really taken on that authority of California to do this, which is, as much as anything, a states' rights issue.
The Trump administration's proposal comes after a federal study found higher emission standards would make cars more expensive and might make people compromise on safety. A similar study done under President Obama found the opposite. State Attorney General Josh Shapiro says if emission standards are rolled back, he plans to file suit against the federal government. Katie Meyer in Harrisburg.
Environmental groups say the Trump administration's rollback of an Obama-era coal ash rule could threaten Pennsylvania groundwater. EPA Acting Administrator Andrew Wheeler recently signed the new rule. For State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier has more.
Coal-fired power plants often dispose of their ash in ponds or landfills, but they can leach toxins into groundwater. In 2015, the Obama administration created new rules for how these sites are built and mandated groundwater testing near them. But the Trump administration, after lobbying from the utility industry, just loosened those rules. One change is the EPA will now give extra time for old, leaking coal ash ponds to close down. Lisa Evans is an attorney with the environmental group Earth Justice.
We think that this gives relief to industry at hundreds of leaking coal ash ponds across the country.
The new rules also relax groundwater monitoring requirements. Evans says this, too, is a bad idea.
It's often not easy to know where the plumes of contamination go, and so groundwater monitoring is a critical safeguard to ensure that if leaking is occurring, it's stopped.
That includes Pennsylvania. According to data released this year, groundwater at several coal ash sites in the state show levels of pollutants like arsenic several times higher than federal drinking water standards. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
The waste from burning coal is one issue, and how coal is mined is another. Coal companies in central Appalachia have used mountaintop removal to mine coal for decades. The controversial process blows the tops off of mountains to reach the coal seams below. Researchers and policymakers have struggled to understand the full extent of mountaintop removal across the region. Ohio Valley Resources' Brittany Patterson reports on a new study that provides a big-picture view of the mining method's impact.
Turns out, if you want a clear picture of what is going on here on Earth, one place to look is to space. That's what researchers from Duke University and the nonprofits Sky Truth and Appalachian Voices did.
The primary imagery we used were from the Landsat satellites.
That's Andrew Parasek, a research analyst at Duke University and lead author of the new study. He says since the 1970s, Landsat satellites, which are operated by the U.S. Geological Survey and NASA, have been circling the globe, taking a photo of every location on Earth every 16 days. For years, researchers have known satellite imagery can be a great tool, but it requires a lot of computing power to process. Enter Google. The tech giant has uploaded a ton of satellite images into the cloud. Using Google's Earth Engine platform, Parasek and his team analyzed 10,000 Landsat images of Central Appalachia between 1985 and 2015.
This isn't really something we'd be able to do before. If I tried to run this on my own computer, it would have literally taken probably years to process.
When taken together, the researchers were able to measure the full scope of mountaintop removal mining across the region.
About 3.5%, so about 2,900 square kilometers of our study area in Central Appalachia has been directly impacted by surface mining.
Christian Thomas is a geospatial analyst with SkyTruth who worked on the project. He says adding the new findings to other work his organization did about earlier mining in the region reveals a total of some 1.5 million acres of disturbed land. Here's Parasek again.
That's about 2.8 times the size of Great Smoky Mountains National Park. So it's a really big area that even I still have sometimes like wrapping my head around just how big of an area that is.
Or put another way, the total affected mine lands are roughly equal in size to the state of Delaware. The researchers say this tool, which is free and available to the public and other developers, can be used by scientists, nonprofits, and even local or state governments to dig into how mountaintop mining may be affecting people and the environment nearby. And while the goal of the project wasn't to analyze if and how mountaintop removal has changed over the last 30 years, the researchers wanted to give an example of how the new data could be useful. They compared how much land was mined to how much coal was being produced on a year-by-year basis. From 1985 to 2005, the researchers found it took about 10 square meters of land to produce 1 metric ton of coal. By 2015, the amount of land needed to get the same amount of coal had tripled.
We think it's a really strong way to demonstrate that even though we're really just presenting these maps, they can be tied to a lot of different spatial or a lot of different data sets to reach some new and interesting findings.
The study was published Wednesday in the open source journal PLOS One. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Brittany Patterson.
The Ohio Valley Resource is a public media partnership made possible with support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Summer is sizzling, and so is the famous hot dog man of the Delaware River.
Can you get a hot dog, chips, and a drink?
Yeah. I've had JOBs, and I never want to go back. My office is, you know, usually the boat.
That's right. He grills hot dogs and burgers from a barge for hungry vacationers floating down the river. Sounds like heaven. That's coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay tuned. Recently, President Trump's image showed up somewhere unexpected. On the side of a pallet of asbestos. A Russian mining company that's one of the largest producers of asbestos posted a photo on Facebook boasting that Trump approves of their product and says that it's 100% safe. Many environmental and health advocates disagree. Asbestos is actually 6 silicate minerals that look like long, thin fibers. It's been used for decades to make products like insulation, though it's no longer allowed to be used for that purpose in the U.S. But breathing in these fibers or swallowing them has been linked to up to 15,000 deaths a year, according to the Environmental Working Group Action Fund. In Pennsylvania, those deaths are higher than the national average. People die from diseases like lung cancer and a rare cancer called mesothelioma.
This cancer is preventable, and that's what's so angering.
Heather Von St. James is a 12-year survivor of pleural mesothelioma. She says most people die within 18 months of a diagnosis. She works alongside the Mesothelioma Cancer Alliance to advocate for an outright ban on asbestos in the U.S. Its use is banned in 55 countries, including the U.K. I was kind of surprised by your story about how you were exposed to asbestos, considering your age. Can you share a little bit about your story?
So I was diagnosed with malignant pleural mesothelioma, which is the asbestos-caused cancer, when I was just 36 years old. I was a new mom, and I was sick. I was horribly, horribly sick. And I got this diagnosis of mesothelioma and was completely, utterly shocked. And then the doctor looked at me and said, "Did your dad ever do mining or construction?" And I was like, "Oh my gosh, yeah, my dad was a construction worker when I was growing up, worked in a mine. There's a lot of gold mines where I grew up." And we came to determine that I was exposed to asbestos through my dad's work clothes. He had worked a lot with asbestos doing drywall, demolition. He tore apart boilers, all of these places where asbestos was present. And he would come home with it on his jacket and on his clothes, and it was in his car. And I would hug him or go for rides in his car, and all the asbestos was there, and I breathed it in. And 30 years later, I ended up getting sick.
I think when many people think of asbestos, they think old buildings, that it's a product and also a problem of the past. Where are exposures from asbestos coming from today?
With the DIY craze, HGTV is bigger and better than ever. And everybody's like, "Oh, I'm going to be the next Joanna Gaines, and I'm going to break into these walls and open up this wall between my kitchen and my living room." And there's a lot of houses that have asbestos in them. Anything built before now, they're saying 1990. There's probably asbestos present somewhere in the home, whether it be the siding, whether it be the roofing, the insulation around pipes, in the drywall. So during DIY is when a lot of people are coming into contact with it, and they don't even know it. And so they're saying it's like a third wave of people getting diagnosed, and it's people who started doing demolition in their homes. And that's what's scary. And now this administration isn't going to do anything about environmental or asbestos already in the environment.
Under the overhauled Toxic Substances Control Act, asbestos is one of the 10 high-risk chemicals that EPA is set to evaluate based on its health impacts. But the Trump administration's sort of framework for this risk evaluation will set aside most legacy uses of asbestos, like in older homes and schools. What do you think of EPA's handling of asbestos in previous administrations and now?
I think it's horrible. Asbestos is a known carcinogen, and it kills people swiftly. And not banning it, for one, is just abhorrent, in my opinion. But continuing its use just makes me sick to my stomach, and not controlling its use. But now ignoring the fact, like you said, the legacy asbestos, ignoring the fact that it's in literally millions of homes throughout the United States. Vermiculite insulation is in how many homes? You know, even if it's just asbestos tape around some ductwork in your home, that's still too much. They have banned or, you know, tried to control some uses of it. You know, any basically home uses of it. Like, you can't just go buy a bag of asbestos and use it. It's not used in home things. Like, they used to have asbestos snow, for God's sake. Fake snow that you would put on your Christmas tree. So any of those types of uses, obviously they're not using it anymore, but it's still used in commercial applications. The highest usage of asbestos is the chloralkali industry. That's who imports most of the asbestos, and they're actually located in, the biggest users of it are located in Louisiana. And it's the filters that they use in the chloralkali industry are what use the asbestos.
Well, and under the amended TSCA, Toxic Substances Control Act, EPA has proposed requirements for manufacturers regarding new uses of asbestos.
It's not enough. You know, it's like it's not going to be enforced. And that's the tragedy, is they can say all they want, but nothing ever changes. So until actual legal ban happens, and even then, honestly, I still think I don't know what's going to change. I mean, they tried banning it, then it was overturned, and it's just pretty much been set on a back burner. Like, oh, it's not that important. It's horrible. I've seen what this disease does to people. I personally have experienced it. I mean, I missed the whole first 2 years of my daughter's life, basically, because I was so sick. Nobody should have to go through that because it's not convenient or it's going to cost too much money.
Do you think that a ban or at least stricter regulations were on their way with the reformed TSCA before the Trump administration? Do you think this new administration is sort of standing in the way of more reform?
I felt like we were building momentum, and finally getting asbestos named as one of the top 10 chemicals to have a look at was huge, because before it was just never really talked about, except for when we would go to Washington and try to bring it up. So having it on the TSCA reform was like a lot of work, and we finally got it there, and it was triumphant. And then to have them come in and just kind of wipe all that out was really heartbreaking. And all of the work that we've done for the last 4 or 5 years, or in my friend Linda's case, you know, her lifetime of work, basically had been flushed down the toilet. And it was disheartening. And it really felt like what we did was for nothing. So I was hopeful that we were gaining momentum, and it was the first step to hopefully banning any future uses of it or any future imports of it. And now I don't feel that way. So, you know, I don't feel hopeful at all anymore, to be honest with you, about it getting banned during this administration.
What about the next? Or, you know, what are you doing to sort of keep the fight going?
Well, we're not giving up. I mean, we're not throwing in the towel. We're not giving up. I think changing tactics, and I think until you educate people about it, nothing is going to happen. Until people get angry, and it needs to be more than just, you know, the few of us that are angry about it, a whole bunch of people need to realize where it is, the danger it poses, and then maybe people will stand up and take action, and then we can see a ban.
Heather Von St. James is a survivor of mesothelioma, a cancer caused by asbestos exposure. There's more about her story and what to do if you suspect there might be asbestos in your home, office, or school at AlleghenyFront.org. And an episode of our Trump on Earth podcast delves into the changes of the chemical safety rules under the Trump administration. That's at TrumpOnEarth.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Kara Holsapple. In Pennsylvania, 11,000 oil and gas wells have been drilled since the fracking boom came to the state a decade ago. Many of these wells are on farms and fields where Native American and colonial artifacts are buried. But a loophole in state law lets companies drill at these sites anyway, without first considering their impact on archaeology. For State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports.
On her family's ridgetop in Washington County, Karen LeBlanc edges her SUV down a newly built dirt road.
This used to be all flat field here. That used to be the view that we had. What we just drove through was a long line of Osage orange trees.
Those trees are gone, and in their place, a construction site, backed up by a big pile of dirt, really a small hill created by bulldozers. This is the land LeBlanc grew up on. This Christmas will mark 100 years since her family has lived here. EQT is developing a well site on a neighboring property, up to 16 shale gas wells extending thousands of feet underground. To access it, EQT built a road through her mother's field.
Their road will go down this way, and over on the other hill is the well pad.
To keep enough water on hand to frack the wells, the company planned to build an impoundment, or artificial pond, right here. But that would put it right next to her mother's house. Her mother is 81 and recently underwent chemotherapy, so LeBlanc wants the company to move the impoundment away from her house. She doesn't think the lease her mother signed 11 years ago gives EQT the right to construct all of this on her property, but the company disagrees. The two sides are fighting over the surface agreement. One prong of LeBlanc's fight is what lies beneath the ground where the impoundment would go. About 80 years ago, so the story goes, her uncle made a discovery there.
He was out exploring, actually plowing for corn in the field, and the plow struck the skull of the Indian bones. They dug it up. They saw what it was. It was viewed by several people.
Her uncle dug up the bones, but eventually reburied them, she says, to prevent looting. In 1981, the state placed the farm on its archaeological survey, a running list of potentially significant sites. But because of a loophole in state law, EQT wasn't required to check that list before it started work. LeBlanc is worried that if it digs up the field, EQT could be destroying a piece of Washington County's past. This bothers her for two reasons. Number one, it turns out one of her ancestors was Cherokee Indian. And the second reason is simple humanity, she says.
If this is your final resting place, why do we need to disturb you? You were there first. You have your right to remain there. They came after. They can move.
To press her argument that the land should be preserved, LeBlanc has enlisted help from local archaeologists. John Nass of California University of Pennsylvania is the archaeologist supervising the dig. He says this is a Native American site that likely dates back hundreds of years.
And this is what we call late prehistoric. So it postdates 1000 AD. The people who lived here, we don't know what they called themselves. Archaeologists call them the Monongahela tradition.
The site could have been a village or have religious significance. It's unclear. Cassandra Cappy is one of a group of West Virginia University students here today. After sifting through dirt on a screen, she pulls out her cell phone and flips through pictures of objects the team has found in the past few weeks. These include an arrowhead and tools made of stone.
This is prehistoric pottery. It has the marks in it from where they would put like twine or leaves to make the marks. And then on the other side, it's dark black, so we know it was cooked.
In an email, a spokeswoman for EQT said that in response to LeBlanc's, quote, credible claim that the site held human remains, the company hired an archaeologist to survey the field and put a hold on construction there. That evaluation is ongoing, and when it's over, the state will review it and make recommendations about how to mitigate or offset any damage the project would do. But even if the site has a big archaeological significance, nothing in state law prevents EQT from basically doing what it wants here, says John Nass.
For a private property, there's nothing we can really do about it. If you bought property that had a site on it, technically it belongs to you. Even if it's recorded with the state, you could bulldoze it away if you wanted to.
The reason is that the strength of the state's historic preservation laws really varies on what you're building. If your project is getting federal permits or grants, say a highway or a pipeline, then your project needs to get some type of archaeological review. In theory, the same is true for projects that require a state permit, like oil and gas wells. But here's the thing. Pennsylvania has a loophole called the 10-acre exemption. If a project is under 10 acres in size, no review is needed. And the vast majority of shale gas wells are under 10 acres in size. That means companies, as is the case with EQT, don't even need to check to see if their well pad is already listed on the state's Register of Historic Sites.
In that instance, even known sites could very well be destroyed or affected.
Ben Ford is an archaeology professor at Indiana University of Pennsylvania. He says one 2012 study found that in Washington County alone, 60 known sites were damaged or destroyed by gas drilling. Ford thinks state law is allowing the needless destruction of Pennsylvania's cultural and historic heritage. He'd like to see these laws get stronger. Doing away with the 10-acre exemption would be a good start.
What we're usually striving for is to gather enough information and data and know about people in the past while still having construction happen and development happen. So we're trying to strike that balance. And at least in my opinion, the current Pennsylvania state law has disrupted that balance.
If the balance is not tipped back, he says, we could be losing our ability to understand thousands of years of Pennsylvania's past. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
For most people, summer is synonymous with vacation. But for the people making a living off of those vacationers, the season is all business. WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Arendt takes us to the middle of the Delaware River.
On a mild stretch of river just south of Frenchtown, New Jersey, you'll find the perfect blend of classical elements. There's water, wind, and fire.
When I go on the river to this day, all my problems go away.
That's Greg Krantz. He's responsible for the fire part. In the late 80s, a local businessman came to Krantz with a problem. The businessman rented tubes to people who would float down the river and sometimes trash the place in the process. The people who owned fancy homes on the Pennsylvania side of the river weren't exactly happy with him.
They were complaining that people would, during a storm, would go across their property or they would bring coolers or alcohol.
The businessman told Krantz he should open a hot dog stand in the middle of the river. It would tempt the tubers to stay toward the other bank instead of crisscrossing all over the neighbor's property. Plus, it would keep them from bringing their own food and trashing up the river.
I said, nah, that's a crazy idea. And then he brought it up again a week or two later. And we said, all right, we'll give it a try. And that's when we were all joking around. Oh, yeah, we're going to be the famous river hot dog man. And we went out and did it.
Over 31 years, Krantz has become kind of famous, at least among the thousands of tubers who float by his stand on summer days. The business started on the banks of a small island, but today, he and his family sell hot dogs, burgers, nachos, candy bars, chips, and sodas from a floating barge in the middle of the Delaware River.
Can you get a hot dog, chips, and a drink? Yeah.
I've had J.O.B.'s, and I never want to go back. My office is, you know, usually the boat.
These days, Krantz has ceded a lot of the work to his four sons. Matthew is the chief operating officer.
I'm a hot dog man, but he's the original hot dog man.
15 years ago, the family opened their own tubing business, Delaware River Tubing. Together with the hot dog stand, they make enough money to get by. But it can be a fickle trade.
Our weekend business is 60% of the organization, so if we lose 2 weekends, that hurts us big time. I mean, we're only dealing with 12 solid weeks of operation.
Matt's salary can fluctuate wildly from year to year based on how good the weather is on those 24 days of weekend during the summer. We're talking tens of thousands of dollars.
River taketh, river giveth.
So how does the famous river hot dog man stay sane given the crazy swings in his bottom line?
I don't handle the sanity all too well. Take pills for that.
And working on the water, it turns out, is its own form of medicine.
It still has that soothing effect on it. So if you haven't been out there and you haven't tried it, you need to. And you need to come with us. You need to see the hot dog man. You need to kick back, listen to some music, and let your kids tear the place up. We don't care. They can't hurt it.
But Krantz says this is more than a business pitch to him. He considers tubing a form of what he calls conservation by immersion.
We need the Delaware, and everyone needs to appreciate it. So what I mean by immersion is people come, they go in, just letting them have that experience, seeing how clean it is, pristine. Hopefully thousands of people go back home and realize how important it is to keep it that way.
One dip in the Delaware, Krantz says, and you'll appreciate everything the river offers. And of course, you can't appreciate anything fully on an empty stomach. Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
Thanks for taking time out of your summer and joining us on the Allegheny Front. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation.